From PRI, Public Radio International in Los Angeles, I'm Tavis Smiley. On today's program, controversial decisions in high-profile cases, like the one involving ex-Stanford University swimmer Brock Turner and the police-involved shooting deaths of people of color, have led many to see the judicial system as biased. This erosion of trust has prompted influential judges to call for a new openness with the communities they serve. Earlier this year, I hosted a town hall meeting called Courting Justice to address this issue. It was produced in partnership with the National Center for State Courts and Loyola Law School in Los Angeles, which hosted the event. In the next hour, you'll hear five Supreme, appellate, and trial court judges from across the country engage in an open and frank conversation with representatives from different communities and organizations about how courts can deliver on the promise of justice for all. Our panelists are California Supreme Court Chief Justice Tani Cantillo Sacaue, Judge Jimmy Edwards from the 22nd Judicial Court in St. Louis, Associate Justice Maria P. Rivera of California's 1st District Court of Appeal, Judge Daniel J. Buckley of the Superior Court of Los Angeles County, and Chief Judge Eric T. Washington of the District of Columbia Court of Appeals.
All right. Chief Judge, I think I want to start with you because I want to confess to the audience that this was not my idea. I'd like to take credit for this, but I can't. You all actually reached out to me, reached out to us and suggested that now was the most propitious time to have this kind of conversation. You didn't put it in this way in particular, but it seems to me, and I think the audience writ large, that with a presidential race, with implications for who will be on the next Supreme Court, with a Supreme Court vacancy for that matter, and then this case of Brock Turner here in California that's outraged the nation in ways that I can't even describe. The timing, again, couldn't be better for this conversation. You didn't necessarily know all of that when you reached out to us about doing these series of town hall meetings, but tell me why judges are willing to take off the robes, come off the bench, and engage in a conversation with the people you serve.
Well, I think the short answer is that judges' stock in trade is the public's trust and confidence that we will protect rights and liberties and that we'll resolve disputes fairly. And yet, what we were seeing around the country in light of what had happened in Ferguson and the law enforcement involvement in Baltimore and around the country was an erosion of that trust and confidence beyond what it had been before. Mm-hmm. And we understood that people, the community large at large, was very interested and very confused about the role courts play in the justice system generally, and especially with respect to law enforcement. But the issue for us was one of trust and confidence. Without engaging, without trying to figure out why they believed that we were somewhat complicit in this justice system that they viewed as unfair, we could never address the problems from within. And certainly we have an obligation to self-examine to determine whether we can do better so that communities who come before us wanting justice will feel as though we've done our job.
So since you went there, let me follow you in. Are judges complicit?
Judges, in terms of complicity, are following the system, are performing within the system that we have. Judges are looking and doing what they believe is right. The system is one that starts at the earliest stages with, of course, law enforcement and arrests and prosecutors, both of whom are part of the executive branch, both of whom we have absolutely no control directly over. Where judges have an opportunity to make a difference is when those cases are brought to court. And then in terms of making a difference, what our role is to be fair and impartial arbiters, to be the persons who conduct and allow people to have their day in court and to conduct themselves and present the best cases they can.
I wonder, Judge Rivera, whether or not it is your opinion that the damage that's already been done, particularly in communities of color, is irreparable.
Oh, I would never say it's irreparable, but I think it's definitely a wake-up call. The California courts have been studying the whole issue of trust and confidence in the courts, and particularly the trust and confidence of minority communities and immigrant communities in particular in the courts. We started back in 95 and then we followed up again in 92 and followed up again in 2005. The good news in California is that we got better. Mm-hmm. Now, I'm looking at what came out of the National Center for State Courts and they're saying, well, yeah, what we've lost some ground, recently. And that may well be true, because I think so many of these high-profile cases across the country suggesting that there's a two-tier justice system has eroded that trust and confidence as a general matter. Mm-hmm. The question I think that we grapple with as the California judiciary is there are many, many institutional things that we need to re-examine in order to regain that trust. So we're looking at all kinds of things, including language access, disability access. We're looking at the fairness statistics. We have a really grave concern, and we are an ongoing process of reviewing and retraining our judges in procedural fairness, matters of implicit bias. All of those things are being looked at as an institutional mm-hmm. matter to improve the trust and confidence.
I want to discuss some of those issues in this conversation. Let me come to Judge Cantillo Sakaue, and let me preface this by saying I know that there's only so much you can say about this, and that is the Brock Turner case. But as I mentioned earlier, there's such outrage in the nation. I know you can't say much about it because we elect judges here in California, and there is a process to recall this judge. It's now underway. I know that your court is being petitioned. The California State Legislature is trying to figure out what authority they have to get this judge out of office who sat and made this decision for a six-month sentence and probation for this rape that Mr. Turner committed on this, we are told, unconscious victim. So I know you can't speak to the particulars of the case because it might come to you, but I guess my question is more broadly, how should the nation judge justice or the lack thereof in the state of California?
Well, I think those are very good questions, and we're having the kind of dialogue that we should be having now in California and nationally. And I think it brings to light several factors. And the first factor I would say that it shines a light on is the public outrage, the public reaction to the sentence. I think it's understandable. We expect that. And the public, I think, is showing its concern in a healthy way. Mm-hmm. A, by the legislature looking into impeachment proceedings. B, by the public right now outside our California Supreme Court with a petition to the Commission on Judicial Performance asking that independent commission with a majority of public members about whether or not they'd take the case and bring charges to remove that judge from office. At the same time, I understand the visceral reaction to 6 months for three felony counts, including a rape. On the other hand, I look also through it through the lens of the Chief Justice of California. I look through it as the lens as a judicial officer. And it's at this time that I caution and I say, yes, I understand the outrage, but now is a time also to bring a voice of some sanity and to step back and say, the outrage, the reaction is appropriate. But let's not lose our heads over this. Let's remember that the judiciary performs an important check and balance on the other two branches of government. Let us remember that judges are not politicians in black robes. Let us remember that we want judges to be able to provide a check and a balance, to be independent, but to be constrained by the statutes. So all I can say basically about the sentence for Brock Turner is it's not unlawful. It's not void. It's not an illegal sentence. It is in within the confines of the statute that permitted this judge to exercise his discretion to sentence. And so there's a lot of room between what's illegal and what's appropriate. But I also will say, I've been a judge for over 25 years, and judicial sentencing is subject to a great deal of discretion. I think all of us would say that. And I think that we have to be careful and not turn it into what could potentially be seen in some far outer reaches as we sentence by popular vote.
I hear your wise counsel, and yet I think the question is whether or not you think that judges have too little or too much discretion.
I believe that judges have sufficient discretion. And I believe, though, it has to be an educated discretion. And judges' discretion is always informed by, A, their personal background, their experience, their values, their principles, but most importantly, by the statutes that the legislature passes and the governor signs that says what a judge can and cannot do. And in addition to what Justice Rivera was saying about the strides we make in trying to raise the consciousness and educate our judges, I want to be clear that we heavily teach the disciplines of law as well. That is first and foremost our commitment, that judges get it right.
Yeah. Judge Buckley, there are a lot of folks, I suspect, who might not argue with me when I make this particular point to you, which is that if in this country there really is justice for all, pardon my English, it ain't distributed evenly or equally. Would you argue me on that point?
I would argue with you in a sense that we don't see what happens every day in thousands of courtrooms with judges trying individual cases, giving individual sentences. We see that, whether it be on appellate review, in my role of working with colleagues on the Los Angeles Superior Court, in my actually getting complaint letters about judges. We see so many times a high, high percentage of our colleagues doing it right and doing it fair and doing it in a sort of individual approach. And that's what we really ask of our bench officers, is that treat each case individually. Don't have a blanket approach to it. Don't because of a race, because of a certain type of charge, whatever else that might be, treat this case individually. And time after time, I would confidently say it is done right.
But you wouldn't argue that the more money you have, the more freedom, the more justice you can buy. You'd argue that for?
First of all, I see, for example, public defenders do the best job in the courtroom day in and day out.
With no resources.
With very limited resources,
yeah.
But extremely talented lawyers. I cannot in any way argue that if one has a lot of money, they can hire a very expensive attorney. And expensive attorneys can do very well. Mm-hmm. But our system is set up, I think, very, very well with a structure where those that are indigent get extremely competent, very competent representation. And again, we see that every day.
You mentioned a moment ago the complaints that you often see about certain judges. If you live in a state where judges are not elected, what agency does the Demos, what agency do we the people really have to deal with judges who are run amok if they're not subject to being recalled or unelected?
Well, in California, which is the one I can address, what I was talking about, first of all, as far as complaints,
right.
If someone writes a letter or sends some kind of a email complaint to the Los Angeles Superior Court, as the assistant presiding judge, I read every one of those, we investigate them, we address them. And if, in fact, some action needs to be done, some counseling is done, we do that. I in fact, do it personally. But ultimately, within California, we have what we call the CJP, mm-hmm. Commission Judicial Performance. The Chief Justice referred to it. And they do a very diligent, careful job in addressing complaints that are brought to them, complaints that they hear about through the public means, through other attorneys and so forth. And from all accounts, they're doing not only a good job, but appropriately aggressive job.
I want to go to Judge Edwards here in just a second, but Judge Rivera, I want to come back to you. It occurs to me in that beautiful blue suit you have on that we know of the blue line that cops tend not to cross when protecting one another. Is there, if I can use this phrase, a black line that
right.
those of you in these black robes will not cross to critique or criticize another judge, no matter what he or she does?
There isn't a black line. The issue here tends to be whenever a judge's decision is called into question, mm-hmm. we are constrained not because we're circling the wagons to protect the judiciary. We are constrained by an ethical rule. The ethical rule is thou shalt not make a comment on a pending or an impending case. Mm-hmm. And so if we're going to be good judges and follow our own rules, that's why we don't speak out. It's not because we are not equally outraged as the public is on some subject that occurs. It's just that we're not permitted to say anything
publicly. So judges
publicly.
Can never be whistleblowers. You all couldn't be
we
whistleblowers.
We are required to be whistleblowers if we see misconduct.
Okay.
We are affirmatively required if there is actual misconduct.
Okay.
So I think there was a case in Orange County where a judge went and was slashing tires in the parking lot. Well, that judge was turned in by
only,
a fellow
only
judge.
Only in Orange County.
That judge was turned in. We
yeah.
have to turn in when the rules or the laws are violated. Not the laws, but when our ethical rules are violated.
Right.
But we cannot, then that we can't cross over that line when we're commenting on some action the judge has taken in a case that is still ongoing.
Okay. Judge Edwards, you sit on the bench in St. Louis. And we all have come to know more about St. Louis than we wanted to know over the last few years, thanks to the outrage of what happened in Ferguson. I want to ask you about a decision, not one that you made, but a decision made where I believe his name is Judge Weber.
Yeah, Judge Richard Weber.
Judge Richard Weber
yes.
did something that, to my mind, was rather unusual. He has released publicly the grand jury testimony in the Michael Brown case. Let me ask you, is that a good decision or a bad decision? And however you take it, however you answer it, tell me what the fallout is going to be one way or the other.
Well, certainly I think that when we assure the public, especially witnesses, that their testimony before grand juries will be kept in confidence, I think it chills witnesses coming forth, certainly to release grand jury testimony. Now, this was done as a result of a civil lawsuit, a wrongful death lawsuit being filed in the state court and removed to the federal court. Judge Richard Weber, a wonderful district court judge, decided that the family had a right to hear all of the testimony, unredacted, of every witness and to see every piece of testimony that was adduced and presented to the grand jury. So is it bad or is it good? From where I sit as a trial judge, I would not have done it. And the reason for that is that I don't want to chill the opportunity of folk coming forward to assist with prosecutions.
So how do you then make decisions as a jurist on what the public has a right to know?
Well, certainly we struggle with that every single day. Mm-hmm. I mean, that's a tough balance. We have access to records. We have privacy. We fight that battle every day as trial judges. Particularly, we try to resolve it with protective orders. And that's what Judge Weber did in this particular case, to issue a protective order and to limit that testimony only to the lawyers that are involved in the case. But it is an ongoing struggle in every single case in terms of balancing access by the public and to the privacy of the litigants and the parties that are involved, whether it's on the civil side or on the criminal side.
I want to get a couple questions from the audience here in the time we have left in this portion of this show. But I want to first come back to you, Chief Judge, and ask you, as an African-American, how it is that you would explain that although there's so much more work to be done to make our courts, our jurists look like America, clearly more work to be done. Nobody argues that point, right? We agree on that. More work to be done in that regard. But we do have the most multiracial, multi-ethnic, multicultural set of jurists, group of jurists we've ever had in this country. And yet I'm trying to square how the court could look more like America than it ever has, and yet so many people in America don't have trust in the system. Does that make sense?
It makes sense.
If the judges were still all white like they were back in the day, I can see why we'd be having this conversation. But when the court is colored and they've got women on the court, why are we having this conversation?
Well, in fact, that is what led us to want to have this conversation.
Right.
We are much more ethnically and gender diverse than we've ever been before. It's not certainly as much as perhaps, it doesn't perhaps reflect mm-hmm. America exactly, but certainly we're in different places. But we are also, as we bring our experiences to that forum and bring our experiences to the art of judging that we engage in, we are still constrained by issues of fairness, rules of evidence. There are lots of things that control how we operate within the sphere of litigating cases. And when I talk about that, it's not in a bad way necessarily. In doing our jobs as jurists are constrained by the law which has been passed in many ways by the communities that we serve. And it could be in response and could be as well-intentioned as any other law. Laws that increase sentencing for drug offenders and made it much easier these long periods of incarceration for people who are sick. Well, those were laws passed by legislative branches responding to their communities who believed that was the answer. We can look back on it in hindsight and say that was wrong. But at the same time, as judges, we had statutes that said for the commission of this crime, the community wants you to address them in this way. As judges, we don't have unfettered discretion. We have discretion within limits.
Where is Deborah Kay? Deborah Kay, there you are. Deborah has a question. Give it to me.
Well, recognizing that judges are often restricted by mandatory sentencing requirements, what do you think judges can do to help young offenders be rehabilitated rather than incarcerated? Being incarcerated can have major impacts on their future.
Thank you, Deborah.
Yes. Yeah. I agree with you wholeheartedly that rehabilitation is more important than incarceration. In my mind, sending an 11-year-old to a detention facility for a small amount of marijuana doesn't make sense. See, the jury formality of learning continues irrespective of whether the child is locked up or whether the child is in school. That begs the question in my mind. How do we want that child back in our community? Do we want that child back in our community with a more sophisticated criminal mind because we've decided to lock them up? Or do we want that child back in our community with the ability to understand what it means to be decent, what it means to be a good citizen? So I believe that rehabilitation is paramount, and it has to start to happen, and we have to be less punitive with respect to children in this community. It doesn't mean we're soft on crime. It means that we're doing the right thing, because those children will return back to our community. Once they have reached majority, those kids are returning back to our community, whether we want them back or not.
Diane Ortiz, where are you, Diane? There you are. Come on, Diane. Give me your question.
You know, dually involved youth, dual status youth, they're on both sides of the system in two jurisdictions in the Department of Children, Family and Children's Services and the juvenile justice system. Knowing that these youth are often the most vulnerable in our communities and that these systems were never set up to communicate with each other, and to exacerbate that, the education system is often completely missing as part of that piece of supporting these young people. What can the courts do? How can the courts improve the process and the positive and successful outcomes for these children?
Judge Buckley.
We recognize that problem. So, for example, in Los Angeles, we have, as we speak, dependency courts and delinquency courts. And we are now trying to bring those two courts together so that the one judge handles both of those situations, handles the issues of the family with respect to the child in the dependency court, and then have that same judge deal with the delinquency charges. And that's also tied to the prior question. I think before we get the children to the court, things are happening. In 07-08, we had 33,000 petitions filed in delinquency courts. Last year, we had only 9,000. Mm. And that's because of pre-filing diversion programs. The district attorney's office deserves credit. Lots of programs deserve credit. And I think the court deserves credit. But you have to recognize that takes more funding, and it's more expensive. And we're obviously willing to do that. But as we deal with the cuts that the court has, to add, if you will, those type of specialized courts, it becomes more challenging in less money times.
From PRI, Public Radio International in Los Angeles, I'm Tavis Smiley. The Courting Justice Town Hall, hosted by Loyola Law School in Los Angeles, continues.
Bias. Is the court biased?
I don't believe the court as an institution is biased. Mm-hmm. I think what we have a need for...
Did you hear that laughter around the country just now? Respectfully.
What we have a need for is a better understanding of what we call our implicit biases.
Okay.
No one sitting on the bench is going to admit, oh, I have racial bias, I have gender bias, I'm biased against immigrants. They're never going to admit that, and they don't believe it. Genuinely, they don't believe they are biased. What they don't understand is that in the last 10 years or 15 years has been the neuroscience developed of implicit bias, the understanding that we were all ingrained, even people of color ingrained with biases in favor of the majority community, the dominant culture. And learning about that is something that I think would very much increase the trust and confidence of the people in the courts if the judges understand that they have implicit biases, just like we tell jurors when they come in. You all have biases. You don't really want to admit that, but you do. And so what we want you to do is not ignore them. We want you to examine them.
But the difference is if your bias or you're believed to have bias in the jury selection process, bam, you get the boot. Can't do that to judges.
No.
If we think they have bias. I can't boot you out.
No. I think that if a judge actually in demeanor and words demonstrates bias against somebody in the courtroom, no matter for what reason, they can be disciplined. Right. So there are means for handling that. Implicit bias, we're trying to deal with that institutionally by requiring every judge who has to go through new judge orientation and 2 weeks of judicial college and ongoing continuing education. And what we've done is we've folded into all of those educational programs training on implicit bias, and not only on recognizing what implicit bias you have, but how to deal with it and how to counteract it.
Let me flip this right quick if I can. And again, I don't mean to make you political, so I want to ask this and frame it in the right way. He is certainly not the first person to publicly criticize a judge, but at the level that he's operating, Donald J. Trump, when Trump says what he has said about a sitting judge, what damage does that do to how we view the judiciary when people who are running for president, who are the presumptive nominees of their party, come after judges in that way?
Well, I'd like to believe that people understand that Donald Trump is a politician, not a judicial officer, not a professor, not an educator. I'd like people to know, and I assume they do, that that's his opinion. And it's his right to have that opinion. But his opinion has the same value as you would consider his other opinions on other things. And so what I think those statements do, and I hope what they do, is that they put a spotlight on the judiciary. And what it means is it gives us an opportunity to explain that we are not judges in black robes. We are not politicians. We are, in fact, honest brokers of the law. We toil in dark courtrooms. We write out our decisions so that if you think something fishy is going on, you can read about that we relied on past cases and we relied on the law and we interpreted it. And if you think that I'm biased, I think you're biased in thinking I'm biased. But yeah. I want to do something about that because I don't want you walking away with the perception that I am. And I was naive enough to believe when Justice Scalia's vacancy came up that this would be an opportunity for civics. How important is the United States Supreme Court and the next president whose foreign and domestic doctrines will live on as long as his legacy, as long as he's in office, but his judicial appointment will live on for 40 to 50 years. Mm-hmm. That's what that means for the rest of us. Of course, I was naive. It didn't turn into that at all. But that's where I thought the conversation should go, the value of your judiciary.
It raises then the issue, Chief Judge, I promised to get to, so here it comes now, about how you view and what the damage is that's being done to the court when it's politicized in this way, talking specifically now about the way Congress has handled or not handled or mishandled the Scalia vacancy. Let's do the court writ large.
Yeah, I think that I would echo actually the Chief Justice of the Supreme Court, who's in essence said that it perpetuates a belief, whether it's true or not, that judges are political appointees and are being chosen for their political views as opposed to their legal acumen, as opposed to being fair-minded people as the community has decided in either an appointment or an electoral process, as being faithful to the law as opposed to faithful to a political agenda. And when you do that, when you decide you're not going to give a judge an opportunity to have a public hearing for political reasons, it perpetuates this view. And anytime that view is perpetuated, or a view that we are political with the big P, that our appointments have something to do with perpetuating someone's legacy as opposed to with deciding cases fairly in accordance with the law, you undermine the whole premise that this country established its judiciary on, to be impartial arbiters, to be the check and balance against unreasonable authority being exercised by the branches of government who can print the money and who have armies.
Yeah.
I mean, we're there to defend the public, and yet this undermines the trust and confidence the community has that we're there for that purpose.
I've known Judge Edwards probably longer than any other judges on this particular panel, and I've been to St. Louis a number of times. And on one occasion, I took the opportunity to actually sit in his court and to watch the way he engaged with these young black men and young black women in St. Louis. But the large point I want to get at is the access or lack thereof to legal services that the kinds of folk you see in your court every day never have a chance of attaining? This notion of legal services.
Well, I think legal services with respect to the African-American communities and our marginalized communities is at its lowest. In fact, African-Americans and marginalized communities have the least amount of trust in our court system than all others. And it just blows me away that starting with the freedom of slave suits to the not-so-equal Jim Crow, to Brown versus Board of Education, to now, today, how has it that the African-American community, who has always relied on the court system for justice, equal protection, and due process, are now concerned? Why? Because of cases all over this country where there is an appearance of unequal treatment because of a lack of representation, adequate representation. When we compare the types of sentencings that African Americans receive compared to their white counterparts for the exact same offense, I believe that those are the types of things that raises this issue of trust. And certainly I think that access to court on the civil side, mm-hmm. being treated fairly on the criminal side. So what is the root cause of all of these things? We've talked about implicit bias, but certainly there are other things. Things like bail. I've created this phrase of sentencing while mad. When judges sentence folk and they're angry and they tend to give longer sentences to those that are standing in front of them, and too often they're young African American men.
You are right about the fact that African Americans have had to rely on the court system more than most other communities, and I'd only add to that, it's not just relying on the court system, but if we're gonna be honest about it, it is in part because of interposition and amendment and nullification that all of that came to be. It just didn't happen because we appealed to a court system, as you well know. But it raises the question, Judge Buckley, and I can make the case either way. I want to get your take on this. I can make the case that we are living in an era now where the court writ large is doing a good job of expanding the rights of fellow citizens. But I could equally make the case, if we were in a tete-a-tete about this, that the court is shrinking the rights of fellow citizens and giving rights to corporations who are people, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera. Is the court expanding rights, shrinking rights?
When I'm asked that question, I have to think of it as a trial court judge.
Okay.
And when you talk about expanding rights, I think we're at the US Supreme Court, maybe the California Supreme Court, depending on the specifics. But if asking, are we trying to restrict the rights at the trial court level, I firmly believe we are not. We're working hard to achieve access wherever we can. We're doing that with something on our shoulder of reduced funding. But every time we look at how to handle a situation, we're looking at trying to provide access to everyone, really provide access to the rights. In my position, I don't think I'm expanding or restricting. I'm trying to provide it.
Chief Judge, I want to come back to you. Judge Edwards put a list out there of other issues that we need to consider when it comes to the lack of trust that the public has in our court system. One of those issues in this election season is voting rights for former felons. Your take on whether we're making progress or regressing on that issue?
With respect to that issue, of course, those are states, mm-hmm. and state law is controlling who votes in their elections. And so there are a number of movements in a number of states to increase the opportunity or to repeal the laws that would prevent felons from serving or from voting. And I think that, I can't speak to each of those individual states and what they're doing, mm-hmm. and the perspective. I know from the court's perspective, though, we have been somewhat complicit in denying rights because many states, for example, have limitations on whether felons can serve as jurors after they've done or served their time after they've paid their debt to society. And so some of us need to look at ourselves in that regard. I think there is some effort on the part of judiciaries who can, it's not statutory. There's statutory limitations, then there's court rules. Where there's court rules, I think there's been a willingness to think about and look at those things, as opposed to the statutory remedies we can't control.
I want the audience to get some of their questions in as well. Susan, give me your question.
In 1963, the landmark decision of Gideon versus Wainwright was made by the United States Supreme Court. The case promised zealous representation to anyone accused of a crime. But I have seen and experienced in ways in which the public defender system has contributed to mass incarceration by cooperating with the machine, pushing people into and through a system instead of trying to get them out of the system. Their role has been to deliver a threat of harsh sentencing to clients if they go to trial and advising their clients to succumb to the threat and to take the plea deal, resulting in many people being pushed into incarceration. It's common knowledge that up to 95% of people charged with the crime take a plea deal, and the criminal justice system is not designed to give people a trial. If 25% of those charged with the crime went to trial, the system would overload and crash. How can we correct this broken system?
Sounds like Susan went to the law break and got herself ready for this question. Good Lord. All right, thank you, Susan. Who wants to?
As a trial judge, Susan, thank you so very much for that question. Firstly, let me say that public defenders all over our country are overworked and probably underpaid, but I can't change that. As a judge, what I can do is when defendants are standing in front of me, I'm very cognizant of the plea. I'm very cognizant of the plea deal. In my state, defendants are permitted to plead non-pursuant to the state's recommendation. So therefore, it gives the judge some discretion with respect to sentencing. And sentencing in my state is what we call indeterminate. So there are ranges of punishment. And so judges do have and play a big role in terms of plea proceedings inside of the state of Missouri.
My 5-year-old son was killed by a policeman, and I used drugs to medicate the pain. I cycled in and out of prison for the next 15 years. There were times when I was in possession of a drug. There were times when I was not in possession of a drug. When I wanted to go to trial, my public defender came to me and said I would get 10 years if I lost. And because I had a prior, he advised against me even going to trial. And I happened to see that over and over and over again while I was doing time in the California justice, California prison system. So I see the unfairness and the inability for any courts across the United States to actually really offer a fair percentage of defendants trial. The realization I deal with is that this system is not designed or equipped to give people a fair trial.
Judge Buckley, you made a point. Stay here. How much of what Susan's talking about has to do with the meager resources that we give to public defenders?
I think there's so many answers to that question. Resources, yes. There is always going to be restrictions on the ability to investigate and so forth. We all have to go through the lenses of our personal experience. And Susan, I definitely hear what you've experienced. What I saw in the courtrooms when I was a felony judge is individual public defenders working extremely hard for their clients, trying, and I think I saw many times, giving advice as to what is the potential jury verdict and what would be the potential punishment and their advice as to what they should or should not do. We talked earlier about discretion.
Right.
Do we want to take away discretion of judges? And so there's a problem there where if you're going to take away discretion,
right,
as the judge mentioned earlier, you're taking away a judge's ability to deal with what might be an unfair situation.
We've been talking about transparency. So let me put you all on the spot and ask you just a question of transparency. What is missing where our public defenders are concerned? Everybody knows, whether you admit it or not, the deck is stacked against so many of these everyday people. What are public defenders not getting that they need? And who's to blame for that?
Well, I'm going to take a stab at it, and I don't. And I say this: public defenders are funded by the county.
Right.
As Judge Buckley said, it is a county board of decision about how the funding is distributed. And I'll also say that the public defenders. I was a trial judge for 14 years in Sac County, and I'm going to echo what Judge Buckley said. I never saw a more hardworking, committed group, especially if they'd been a public defender more than 5 years. If they were 5 years, they were all in. They weren't going in for 5 years just to say they had trial work and were going out to
practice.
Respectfully,
Judge, that's not the point, though, respectfully. The point is now that they aren't hardworking. We know they are. It's not that they're hardworking. It's that they're overworked.
And that's a financial issue. California had 5 years of a recession.
Right.
Everyone was cut. They're still cut. They're still operating from a deficit. And the public defenders were cut up and down the state. And if it makes you, it would be ridiculous to say that money does not play a part in the investigation and preparation of a case. It absolutely does. So it's about a matter of values. Where are people going to put their money? We fight for equal funding. Courts don't want to have see a trial where someone doesn't have the resources. Court wants to see an equal case.
Judge Rivera, Dr. King used to always say that budgets are moral documents. That's your point. That budgets are moral documents. Mm-hmm. You can say what you say, but you are who you are. We see who you are when you put your budget on the table, because budgets are moral documents, Judge Rivera.
I agree.
Yeah.
And there's a saying that says, if you want to know who I am, look at my checkbook and my calendar.
Mm-hmm.
Anyway, I wanted to say that it's a continuum, and I think part of the continuum starts at the pretrial, the bail process. And that's something I won't speak to because we have the world's expert on that here, but there is a very large wave of activity in all the state courts to reform the bail process. Mm-hmm. Because what happens is people like Susan get put in jail, they're too poor to get out, they desperately need to get out, so they plead so they can get out of jail. And there's a lot of studies out there. Human Rights Watch just did a wonderful study in Manhattan on the bail reform. And also, there's a question about whether we should start, after we finish with bail, start looking at the plea bargaining system.
Yeah.
Because there's another Human Rights Watch report that's out that's really good that studied the plea bargaining system. I think it was in Washington, D.C. And whether that benefits defendants or it's detrimental to defendants. And so that's, I think it's something that we ought to take a look at.
My time is just about up. I want to give you the last word, Chief Judge. And I think I want to close and give you 30, 45 seconds to respond to this. For all that we've discussed, all the challenges that the court system faces and the challenge most principally that you have in trying to build the trust in the public in what you do, what gives you reason to be hopeful? How are you sustaining your hope that we can make progress on this?
Well, as an institution, courts, and I'll talk courts generally as opposed to me specifically, I think that it gives us hope that we can find out what would be important to the community by engaging in these types of conversations that you're allowing us to do through this show. It's interesting. We're not just answering questions. We're actually hearing these concerns. And I think it's important for us to hear these concerns. We are taking, as judicial officers, in many ways, steps to correct what we think are the problems. And we're looking at issues like plea bargaining, as was mentioned. And we're looking at bail reform. And we're trying to be proactive in making sure that the justice system, from the beginning to the end, is procedurally fair and is the appearance of fairness is not lost on the general public. So we care about this. We're invested in this system. And so what gives me hope is that people are willing to come out and tell us personal stories like we just heard. And it's not something that we don't understand. It makes us think more in terms of what our obligation mm-hmm. is as judicial officers about making sure that pleas that are people who are coming before us to plea, and we're engaging them in conversation about whether they in fact committed the crime and whether they were prepared to enter that plea, are able to answer those questions honestly, and we can then, from our perspective, decide whether to reject or accept the plea, understanding that we're not trying to get in the middle of the relationship those people have with their lawyers. So we walk a fine balance, but hearing these concerns gives us more to talk about. And I want to say the Conference of Chief Justices, who were the body along with the National Center and the State Justice Institute, pulled together this outreach effort along with the National Consortium on Racial and Ethnic Fairness in the Courts because we're concerned, because hearing from people is what's critically important for any changes that we want to make in the future.
This is, as I said at the top, a very rare opportunity to have these conversations with these judges at this level. Please thank these judicial officers for being here.
Special thanks to our partner in this town hall, the National Center for State Courts and Loyola Law School in Los Angeles, host of the Courting Justice Town Hall event. You can catch me weeknights on my television show on PBS. For more info on what I'm doing or to hear this show, past shows, or the Tavis Smiley Show podcast, visit TavisSmileyRadio.com. The Tavis Smiley Show is a news and opinion program produced and recorded in Los Angeles by SRP Productions in partnership with Public Radio International. Christabel N.C. Abwadi is our executive producer. I'm Tavis Smiley. This is PRI. Keep the faith.